Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores. Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect to your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
And something unusual happened in Britain. Well, many things unusual happened in the spring of 2020, but the one we're going to talk about now was the fact that our view of what constituted a hero changed. An interesting subject, this one, and it's in a brilliant book by Brian Reid called Diamonds in the Mud. And Brian joins us now. Good morning.
Hi, Bill.
Nice to talk to you, Brian. This is a really good one because we are all aware that something did happen, didn't it? And we started to get these people coming to the forefront and even going out to applaud them, of course, every Thursday in some cases. And we kind of forgot the traditional, in inverted commas, heroes.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why I chose to write this book. It was a lockdown book, actually, that kind of started that.
Right.
And it had been a subject that I'd thought about over the years quite a lot. But basically, I think the history in Britain, peculiar to Britain, actually, is taught through a kind of prism of monarchs, of kings and queens, or Eton-educated prime ministers, or public school-educated adventurers. But we rarely do we see the people from below kind of, fated or actually used in schools to teach kids about history.
Yeah.
So I've been a journalist for 40 years. I've interviewed a lot of famous people. So I thought I'd pull together kind of series of interviews of the heroes that I came across. And that's what the book's about, really.
Yeah, you've summed it up beautifully there. And I love the fact that you've used the word famous. Like you, I've been doing this for 40 years or so, and I've also interviewed a lot of famous people. And once you examine that word famous and start to question it, you kind of go, well, hang on a minute. What constitutes somebody being famous, and why does that make them particularly special? In a lot of cases, it's actually just being in the right place at the right time that made somebody famous.
Totally. Ironically, I was interviewing Chris Jagger yesterday, Mick Jagger's brother for the book he's got.
Wow.
And I talked to him about the 60s, because being a brother of Mick, he kind of opened up a lot of gates for him in the 60s.
Sure.
He went to parties, etc. Loads of names up in the book, loads of A-listers, the Marlon Brandos, the John Lennons, the Jimi Hendrixes, the Pete Townsends. And I said, who was the most impressive famous person you met in the 60s? And he thought about it, and he said, it was those people that listened. He said, Marlon Brando listened to you. He said, Pete Townsend used to go to the front of the stage and talk to the fans. It's those who, what impressed them most was not their level of achievement that they did in their own field, but how their own humility, how they had time for other people. And I thought that was, when you think back to the people you've interviewed, saying, I've interviewed prime ministers and a lot of famous film stars, the ones that impressed me are not the ones that seem most impressed with their own achievements, but the ones that listened.
Do you know what? That's absolutely spot on. And when you're talking about the music world, for example, I would say that the ones who have endured tend to have way more humility than the ones who are kind of flash in the pans, who think they're, you know, God's gift to music and have popped up suddenly and disappeared just as suddenly.
That's true, yeah. Interesting, I do something in the book about Paul McCartney, because I've interviewed him a couple of times. And I'm from Liverpool, and you may be able to tell, but McCartney, it was a strange one, really, because I thought, do I include Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney, worth £1 billion McCartney? Do I include him in a book about working class heroes against some like Dennis Skinner and the NHS nurses?
Yeah.
Or the Hillsborough Mothers Report? It was one of those I tossed and turned in my head. But I thought about it. Undoubtedly, the Beatles were working class heroes, because what they did in the 60s, they made fame, if you like. They made fortunes. They made opportunities accessible to working class kids who hadn't really had it before then. If you came from something like Liverpool or Manchester or Yorkshire in the 60s, you were basically encouraged to hide your accent, or you were seen as a dull, provincial, uneducated mediocrity. And they changed that overnight. They said, oh, no, be proud of where you come from. And their spirit soared. And actually, when I came to finish the book, I actually realised that I spoke to McCartney about his mother, who was a nurse.
Yes.
And he was so proud of it. She died when he was 14. It left such an impression on him. And I thought, well, you know what? I'll use that as the intro to the chapter about all the nurses who fought and died on the COVID front line, because McCartney would be the first to admit that actually what they do every day of their lives was more important than the music that he produced, even though it changed so many lives.
Absolutely right. And I guess there's an element of this that's happened quite recently, as social media has become so important to us, and none more so than during lockdown, when we were kind of living their lives with them, these local heroes and these, you know, these working class heroes. And we'd never normally have come across them unless they achieved national status. But people who did good things were getting on social media and we were finding out about it.
Yeah, I think social media is changing things. It's changing things in many ways, obviously. But I think I'll give you an example of how I think it's changing things irrevocably. The footballer Marcus Rashford, who also appears in the book. Now, 5 years ago, a young black working class footballer from Britain was basically a subject for the media, and the media I work in. They used to have a go at them. They would have a go at them. They would say they were kind of bling obsessed. They're only in it for the money. They're kind of... They forget the people they've come from, and they were targets.
Yeah.
Footballers were targets, really. These young generation who just wanted to party, just wanted to buy a new Bentley. And they, more or less over the last few months with social media, that's been turned on its head completely. Yeah. There was Marcus Rashford forcing the Prime Minister of Great Britain to do not one but two U-turns on giving free school meals to the poorest kids in the country. Now, that's unthinkable a few years ago. But it was the power of social media, as you mentioned, Bill. It was social media. It was reaching out to people, going over the heads of our traditional media, if you like, of newspapers that I work for, and actually touching more hearts, touching more minds. And it's kind of, I think it's the future. I think there's many, many bad things about social media. And I think if you're famous, there's a lot of downsides to it.
Yep.
But one thing is, you can get your message out there very, very quickly, and when you've got millions, literally millions of followers, you're getting far more listened to than you are journalists like me who work for national newspapers even.
Yeah, spot on again. And with the football thing, of course, that, you know, Marcus Rashford is one of the exceptions to the rule. But, you know, that some of those things that we did think about footballers, they did bring upon themselves, it has to be said.
True. Yeah, that's true. But I mean, I also do a chapter there on football fans, because again, over the last few years, they've been on this remarkable crusade to fill up food banks. You know, the big problem in Britain now, of course, is food banks is feeding such a large percentage of people on benefits. And football fans organise this themselves. They call fans supporting food banks. They started by putting wheelie bins outside grounds in Liverpool and Everton, and it grew nationally. To the point now where they fill up a third of the local food banks with people donating cans or packets when they go to a football game. And they've now got a bus which they take into a state where people don't have access to supermarkets, and they sell them nutritious food at a cheap price. Now, who'd have thought 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the football fans, English football fans, would be fated for doing something positive? It was the other way around, wasn't it?
Absolutely right. There's a real symbolism, which you talk about actually in the book as well, but it's one I don't think anybody will forget, when the statue of the Bristol slave trader Edward Colston was hauled down into the river there in Bristol, and the Black Lives Matter movement gathered momentum. That really was a kind of... saying to people, look, these people that we did think were heroes and important, things have changed, and a lot of us now have got a very different view of them. That was a particularly striking one, I thought.
I think that's part of a rethink. I think because there'd been, for example, with Cecil Rhodes at Oxford, there'd been students talking about that for years. Why is he there? Why is he there?
Yeah.
And sometimes I think there's been a bit of an overreaction to what happened in Bristol. There's been talk in some sectors of the media that all of a sudden we were pulling down all sorts of statues and renaming all universities.
Of course.
It all became massively woke. Well, actually, it was one statue. It was one statue in Bristol.
Yeah.
And then there may have been campaigns to rename halls of residences, like named after somebody who students perceived to be an evil colonialist. But I think what it did, it made people... just think about their history. I mean, again, when I live in Liverpool, there's so many streets in Liverpool which are named after slave traders. And we've just taken it for granted all these years. You didn't know. That's just another road. But if you're a member of the black community in Liverpool, and you've got to walk down these streets, and you see the name of someone who profited from your ancestors being enslaved, then maybe it's nice. Maybe you should have a debate about it. You don't have to change the name of the street, but a little plaque next to it explaining who this person was, what happened then, and why we don't do it anymore. It's about educating, I think, the next generation.
Yes, as opposed to attempting to rewrite history, which is impossible, clearly.
Yeah, and I think, again, Britain suffers from something with its history. I think a lot of other countries, and this may be go back to the fact that we have won a hell of a lot of wars lately, but I think a lot of other countries who've lost wars or have been colonialised, they examine their history a lot more than we do. I think we use our history at times as a kind of an example of almost exceptionalism, a triumphalism, the great British history that, you know, we cannot be mentioned. I mean, Winston Churchill, for example, was a fantastic leader in the Second World War, no doubt about that. But there's a lot of people, for example, the Mimes and Tonopandy, a lot of bit of Irish people, a lot of working class people generally, who didn't really like Winston Churchill, and hence he lost the 1945 general election by a landslide. Now, that's not to decry Churchill and say he was a bad figure, and we certainly should not be doing anything on his monument. But a debate about it is healthy. You know, a debate about our leaders and everything they may have done, I think it's healthy for our history.
When somebody steps up and does something you're not expecting them to because of their beliefs, that is a kind of halfway to making them a hero, whether or not they succeed. And we've got a kind of almost local story, which you talk about, and that's the extraordinary story of the trade union leader, Jack Jones, who fought fascists here in Spain. He was just basically fed up of what was going on, and off he went. It was an incredible story, wasn't it?
Well, I actually went because I made a film about Jack and the volunteers, the International Brigade, who so bravely came in 1936 to the aid of what was a democratically elected Spanish government.
Yeah.
People kind of say, oh, these are just ragbag communists and anarchists. But actually, it was a democratically elected Spanish government that Franco and the fascists wanted to bring down with the support of Hitler and Mussolini. And they warned governments like the British and the French that if you allow fascism to take a hold in somewhere like Spain, then it will soon be spread across Europe. But blind eyes were turned. You know, there was the idea to placate them. Don't interrupt, it'll be fine, it'll go away. And of course it didn't. And the next thing you know, we're having to fight a six-year war to beat fascism in Europe. But what those young men did, I mean, this was Jack Jones, a 25-year-old from Liverpool, and there was many thousands of them who, he was untrained as a soldier, he was just a docker. And next thing, he's climbing up a hill in Catalonia under the bombardment of snipers, but trained Spanish troops, with shoddy clothes in the summer heat, seeing young men die all around them. just because of his principles.
Yes.
And it's things like that which fascinate me, really.
And standing shoulder to shoulder with, you know, with Spaniards who had their particular beliefs and having really nothing in common except a shared belief.
Yeah. It's so true. And it tells me a great story, Jack, when he was still alive, because he became a great fighter for pensioners, pensioners' rights back home in Britain, and he's loved for that. And he told me, this is going back into the early 90s. He said he bumped into Michael Portillo one day, who then was working in the Treasury, and he said to Michael Portillo, he said, "You know what, Michael? Back in the 30s, I went to Spain to fight for a democratically elected government, and your father, which is a true story, his father was in the cabinet of that democratically elected government."
Yeah.
He said, "You fled, because we fought for you, and you fled to Britain, your father fled to Britain. He educated you, you had a great life in the British taxpayer, and now you're trying to take the pensions off a generation of people who fought for you." He said, "This country has just gone mad."
Wow.
But it's lives like that that interest me. Jack died at 96, but he'd fought for... He fought against poverty, he fought for trade unions, he fought against fascism, and in the end he fought for British pensions to get a better deal for them. And I think, you know, when you spend your life doing something like that, yet your story kind of goes under the radar, well, they're the kind of heroes that appeal to me.
Absolutely. And you alluded to it earlier, the Hillsborough Mothers, there you have people who just refused to take the decision that was foisted upon them. What an extraordinary story they had.
Yeah, they did, and I was at Hillsborough as a fan, and so I knew what happened, and I kind of campaigned with these mothers from word go, really, 32 years ago, and they got so many kickbacks, they lost so many court cases, the system turning us was so much, but they wouldn't give in, and eventually they overturned the inquests on the children's death from accidental death to unlawful killing. They got laws changed. They got the truth established. And I said to one of them, Anne Williams, very early on, I said, "What keeps you going? What is it that, when everyone's telling you to shut up and move on with your lives and accept what happened, what's the motivation for you?" And she said something which really stuck with me. She said, as a mother, when you bring a child into this world, the words on the birth certificate are accurate. When they leave that world, you owe it to them to ensure that the words on their death certificate are accurate. And that's why I'll never stop fighting, which is a beautiful, noble cause, and so true.
Wow. Football, again, I'm not a huge football fan, but I do respect certain people in the game. And Bill Shankly is one which I think is a wonderful story. The words etched on Bill Shankly's statues is about making the people happy. And I think he would have done that, whatever it was he took on in life.
Yeah, he was a fantastic man. I'm a Liverpool fan. He was my first hero, but he was such an inspirational manager. That old school of football management, he wasn't the money, he was in it literally to make the people happy. Felt very, very lucky because he escaped the pit. So football was escape from working on the mine.
Yeah.
And his whole ambitious motivation was to make the people happy. And I said to him one day, because he told me he's a socialist, so what defines your socialist beliefs, if you like? And he said, "Well, you know what?" He said, "Liverpool is a bit of a dirty city. It needs cleaning up."
Yeah.
He said, "I think people should be paid equal pay." I said, "Okay, well, tell me what you mean by that." And he went, "Okay, if I was in charge of the cleaning service of Liverpool, I'd have the cleanest city in the world." I said, "Well, how would you do that?" He said, "Because I would get the best bin men, and I would motivate the bin men, and I'd make the bin men well paid, and I'd give the bin men the best bonuses. And they would do it." And when people turned to me and said, "Well, why do you want to pay the bin men that? Why do you want to treat the bin men so well?" He said, "Well, haven't you got the cleanest city on earth?
Brilliant.
Who's made it the cleanest city on
Brilliant.
Earth? It's the bin men."
Brilliant. Well, that sums up our whole conversation, doesn't it, right there? Brilliant to talk to you, Brian. The book is called Diamonds in the Mud. You can get that from our website, tre.radio. Go there and you'll find the book and it'll save you trawling the internet. Brian, lovely to talk to you today. Look after yourself.
And
you're right. I'd never have guessed that you came from Liverpool, honestly. Not a hint.
Nice one, mate.
Have a good one. Cheers. Take care. Bye-bye.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.